Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Our guest this week is British geographer, TV personality, and author Nicholas Crane. His new book, Latitude, The True Story of the World's First Scientific Expedition, tells the tale of a group of 18th century French academics coupled with a pair of Spanish military attachés who set out for modern-day Ecuador in the quest to measure the true shape of the Earth. Beginning in 1735 and taking a decade to complete, the mission was fraught with exposure in the Andes Mountains, tropical diseases, and even political violence in colonial South America. It's an amazing story, and Crane is the perfect person to tell it, with his own personal experiences in exploring the region as a geographer and adventurer. He joined us recently from his home in England. Nicholas Crane, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to join you.
Well, I had heard of this expedition over the years and was always fascinated by it, but never really got deeply into it as you do in this book. I'd like to know, first of all, how did you decide this was a story you wanted to tell?
Well, I'm a geographer by distant training, and I've spent my entire working life writing books related to geography and presenting TV documentaries related to geography. And I was very, like all of us, captivated by Davos O'Bell's book, Longitude, about the clockmaker Harrison and his many attempts to make a marine chronometer that would allow longitude to be measured accurately at sea. And my publisher came to me, Penguin came to me and said, look, how about doing Latitude? What can you say? It's just an incredible pleasure to tackle this particular story. It has all of the elements of the story in a way are related to my own personal life in some way. I've traveled extensively in Ecuador, where the expedition took place. So I knew the volcanoes, I knew the mountains, I'd been in the rainforest in Ecuador, so I knew much of the terrain that the expedition followed. And I recently finished my three-year fixed term as the president of the Royal Geographical Society in London. So, you know, it just tied up a lot of loose ends at this point in my life. It's also a lockdown book. I got the commission just as the pandemic struck the UK. So there I was. I had this amazing scientific adventure story to research while I was locked away.
Yeah, and that must have presented some interesting problems and opportunities, you know, being in lockdown there in London. How did you go about your research? How did you go about accessing the source material for this?
Yeah, it was a challenge because the British Library, which is my normal port of call, it was when I lived in London, it was just an 8-minute bicycle ride from where I lived. So that was where I would normally have done research for this kind of book. Most of my earlier books had been researched in the British Library. However, it was closed for the pandemic. So virtually all of the research I did had to be undertaken online. But we live in an incredible digital age. So, for example, the journals, most of the documents that relate to the French part of the expedition are available online in Paris. So you can just log on and read an 18th century travel journal online. The University of Texas has the whole of Ecuador mapped at 1 to 50,000, a scale of 1 to 50,000. So I was able to see every contour the expedition crossed online. And then, of course, Google Earth Pro allows you to alight on any point on the surface of the Earth and zoom down to a kind of virtual street view, a digital street view. So I could actually stand on the same volcanoes that the scientists had trodden back in the early 1700s and look at the same view that they had seen. So it was a new experience for me because this kind of digital access to resources wasn't available 10 years ago. It's pretty new.
Yeah, and I can also see how during the pandemic lockdown, having a project like this to work on, where you are virtually traveling to Ecuador and South America there, that must have actually been quite a tonic.
It was, Dave. I mean, it was a lifesaver. I was struggling too. My father was dying in a care home, so I spent much of the time in a tiny, freezing cold cottage in Norfolk, where I had to go into self-isolation just so I could get into the care home. The care home staff said I could visit my father on the condition I lived entirely alone and laundered my clothes every time I came and went from the care home. But in between those visits, I was on my own, locked in the 18th century, reading these journals. And it was a wonderful tonic. And I was able to bring my dad up to date with the latest researches I'd found, tell him the stories, which, as you know, are absolutely amazing. He was a mountaineer himself. So, you know, the stories of getting altitude sickness, of struggling with snow and ice on volcanoes, back in the day before Gore-Tex, you know, these men were wrapped in wool and linen, not Gore-Tex.
Yeah.
Fancy modern alpine clothing. So it was an enormous help to me emotionally to be able to write this book.
First of all, let's talk about the problem itself, the shape of the Earth. Why was this such an important topic and task in the early 18th century? And I know it had something to do with a guy named Isaac Newton.
Yeah, exactly. In a nutshell, everybody in the scientific world knew that the Earth wasn't spherical. It wasn't a perfect sphere. But there was a huge debate raging at the time about whether it was egg-shaped or whether it was pumpkin-like, pumpkin-shaped, if you like, whether it's prolate or oblate. Isaac Newton believed that the Earth bulged at the equator, that it was pumpkin-shaped, and René Descartes, the French philosopher, thought that it was egg-shaped, that it was stretched towards the poles. And this debate, it was probably the biggest intellectual argument of the age. And there were practical reasons for solving it. One was that and without knowing the true curvature of the Earth, you couldn't create accurate sea charts and land maps because you simply couldn't account for the curve unless you knew how much the curve was. And then the other thing, of course, was that this was the height of the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason. This is that in the middle of this extraordinary movement during which faith was overcome by reason, by a pursuit of science and truth, of empirical evidence. So there was a big intellectual drive to actually find out the true shape of the Earth. And the expedition, interestingly, was formed in Paris, despite the fact that the leaders of the expedition believed deep down that the English Newton was correct, not Descartes, the Frenchman.
Yeah, what was did Newton offer reasoning behind his point of view?
Newton was a theorist, so his argument was hypothetical, based on the idea that there were fluids inside the Earth, and that as the Earth span on its axis, those fluids moved outwards through centrifugal force and caused the Earth to bulge at the equator. So it was a hypothetical reasoning by Newton. And in fact, although he wasn't the expedition, the French and Spanish expedition couldn't prove whether the fluid argument was right or wrong, they were able to prove that Earth did indeed bulge at the equator.
Yes, that is, it's the oblate spheroid that, you know, we learn about in grammar school or whenever you encounter that.
Yes, exactly.
Well, let's talk about the makeup of this expedition, because it's a really, truly kind of an international flavor with elements of Spain and France. Tell us about the players.
Yes, I mean, it was a pretty dysfunctional gaggle, actually. So there were 10 Frenchmen and two Spanish naval lieutenants. The French were led by Louis Godin, who was an egocentric, young, a rising star in the Academy of Sciences in Paris, well-connected, very handsome, fancied himself a bit as a ladies' man, and couldn't be trusted to run a boulangerie, let alone an international expedition. But nevertheless, he was the nominal leader. And he gathered around him, or rather the Academy of Sciences gathered around him, two other key members of the French Academy. One was a brilliant mathematician, Pierre Bouguer, who was actually a hydrographer, really. His speciality was marine science, shipbuilding, and the science of shipbuilding. He believed that shipbuilding should update itself and follow the laws of science rather than the habits of carpenters. So that was his big life mission, to revolutionize and make shipbuilding more scientific. A brilliant mathematician. And anybody working with ships and the sea was also, by nature, a very good astral navigator, very good astronomer. Now, the third member of the French team was Charles-Marie de la Condamine, my favorite of the three.
Oh, mine too. This guy is an absolute character. I found myself going, you know, it's like, oh, let's get back to Le Condamine, because he's just hilarious.
Oh, I'm so pleased you liked him too. I've got to say that in the story that I told, I probably gave him rather more than he deserves in terms of coverage. But, you know, how could you avoid it? You know, he's such a character, isn't he? A maverick, curious, eccentric.
He's always kind of, you know, going off on his own to do something, and sometimes with semi-disastrous results.
Exactly. I mean, completely ungovernable. I mean, it's a, you know, not a team player, really, it has to be said. I think Pierre Bouguer was the one who held the whole thing together in the end.
Yes, he's kind of the glue.
He's the glue. He's the intellectual glue. But La Condamine is the energy, and he provides this kind of essential dose of reckless ambition. He was completely fearless. I think I didn't really dwell upon it, because otherwise the book would have been 10 times longer. But one of my favorite aspects related to La Condamine is when eventually this expedition was completed, with after all sorts of disasters, and the survivors basically tried to get back to Europe by the safest, quickest means they could. La Condamine decided that it would be much more interesting to go back to Europe if he built a balsa wood raft and descended the entire length of the River Amazon first.
And yeah, it's like, after you've spent like 10 years on this expedition, you decide it's a good idea, let's go down the length of the Amazon.
Yeah, not easy. But so those are the three leading Frenchmen. And then there were seven, a mixture of tradesmen and assistants, also from France. They included a surveyor, a draftsman, an instrument maker, and so on. And then the two Spanish naval lieutenants were brought in to ease access to Spanish South America, because without a Spanish part of the expedition, the mission wouldn't be able to go to South America, wouldn't get the permissions necessary to travel in South America. So the Spanish king deputed these two trained killers, these special service operatives, to join the expedition. They proved to be, if you like, the steely backbone of the mission, but they caused their own problems, on one occasion murdering somebody, which didn't really help the cause of science at all.
Yeah, they're trained to kill, and they did.
Yeah, I mean, they were young. I mean, the youngest of the two was only 19 when they sailed. And they were both battle-hardened veterans, even at 19. They'd both sailed with the Spanish fleet. They'd both been involved in battles and so on. They were brilliant navigators. They were extremely able. Although, interestingly, you know, they'd spent their lives, they'd joined ships before the age of 10, but they were not used to extreme land travel. So put them on the deck of a ship in a storm or a sea battle, no problem at all. Put them in on a volcano during a lightning storm, and they got real difficulties. And one of the two had to overcome some serious fears when he first saw a mountain and had to tackle it.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation about the first scientific measurement of the shape of the Earth in the 18th century. We'll be back with geographer and writer Nicholas Crane. Stay with us. And we're back. If you're just joining us, our guest is Nicholas Crane. His new book, Latitude, The True Story of the World's First Scientific Expedition, describes the adventures of a group of French scientists trying to measure the shape of the Earth by determining the length of a degree of latitude in the South American Andes at the equator. One of my favorite characters doesn't get mentioned a lot, but I just, you know, he's just so competent, is a guy named Hugo, who is able to just, it's amazing. It's like, you need something built, an instrument. Okay, you know, this guy will just make it for you on what he's got there, because he built some amazing instruments. Let's talk a bit about the equipment that they took with them and what they were planning to do with it. Because first thing I want to know is, what kind of scientific instruments did they have at this time?
Well, they took with them the latest instruments from England. At the time, London was the best place to go and buy scientific instruments. So it kind of adds in another international element to the expedition, because although the main personnel were French and Spanish, they could not have undertaken the work they were doing without those British scientific instruments. And there were two main instruments. There was a quadrant, and that was used for measuring angles between peaks or signals or places, and was the key instrument for the process they were undertaking called triangulation, which is to measure the distance on the ground very, very accurately using hypothetical triangles. Once you've measured the baseline of the first triangle, one side of one triangle, you don't have to measure any other horizontal distances on the ground. You can calculate the size of all of the subsequent triangles by only measuring angles. And for that, they used these quadrants, which were very heavy, mounted on an iron stand, a bit like a set square, and you had a sighting telescope along one side of it, and you sighted that on one of the signals on a distant volcano, for example, and then you moved the quadrant arm until it was on the other point that you wanted to measure the angle between. Then you read off the angle on a scale. So the quadrant was, if you like, the workhorse of the land survey, but the workhorse of the astronomical survey that followed was a nightmarish instrument called a zenith sector, which was so huge that it only really could be used inside its own observatory. So they had to build an observatory to accommodate this very fragile, sensitive instrument with an immensely long telescope attached to it.
Yeah, and so you're essentially, what you're trying to do is, since you're pointed at directly overhead, the zenith, they're trying to measure the angular distance, the angular separation of stars near the zenith, right?
That's right. So what they're doing is locking each end of this chain of triangles to the sky. They've got the distance measured on the ground, but then they've got to anchor it latitudinally using a known star, Epsilon they used, and they measured the height above the horizon of that star using the zenith sector. And what they discovered after an immense amount of trial and error was that the only way of getting the results they needed was to try and measure the same star at the same time from both ends of the triangles, with the chain of triangles, which was kind of over 200 miles long. So technically incredibly difficult to do in an age before mobile telephones, and with these very sensitive instruments. But that's what they eventually managed to achieve.
Yeah, I thought it was cool that they were using that particular star, because Alnilam, which is the name of that star, the center belt star in Orion, it's a super bright, beautiful star. And when I think about it from the northern hemisphere, it's always in the southern part of the sky for me, fairly low. But for them, near the equator, it would have been like directly overhead. And I was imagining, wow, what would Orion and the belt stars look like that straight overhead? That must have been quite spectacular when the air was clear. And often, as you state in the book, it was not.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The reason that they chose it was that it is so bright, and that, as you say, right over the equator, it should have been the brightest place that it's observable from. And of course, they were up high anyway. Quito, where and the Cordillera there are 6, 7, 8,000 feet up. So they were above the coastal haze, and it should have been, they expected it to be a very straightforward operation, the astronomy, but in fact it was a total nightmare because of the fickle weather of the Andes. So perpetually they found that the cloud cover or rains obscured the star, or there were, the zenith sector was disturbed by earthquakes, and then there was a very strange anomaly that tripped them over big time, which was this, and I'm not an astronomer, but the habit of stars to wander, so they're not actually in the say exactly the same place. And if you're trying to make very accurate measurements using an immensely powerful telescope, the wandering star can throw off your results.
Well, a lot of that would have to do, any kind of atmospheric turbulence, that's going to throw off the position of the star quite a bit. And, not to mention just the slight wobbling of the Earth. It's not an easy thing to do. So I could see that. But one thing that really, stood out in my mind as I considered this is, of you're trying to figure out the distance of a degree of latitude at the equator to, and then compare it to farther north or south. Why go there? Why go to one of the most difficult places to explore, the Andes? Why did they decide that was the place to do this?
Well, France sort of, this is a huge generalization, but roughly halfway between the equator and the North Pole, they had to go to one of those two extremes. They'd already got the length of 1 degree of latitude measured in France. So that was the comparator they were planning to use. So to what they needed to know was whether 1 degree of latitude was longer or shorter, either at the North Pole or at the equator. Well, the North Pole was just too difficult to get to. Indeed, hadn't been visited at that point. And so the only option was equatorial, but looked at from Europe in the early 1700s, equatorial Africa would have appeared to have been just a complete no-go area. Not only was the slave trade in absolutely going at full throttle, but most of the parts of equatorial Africa known to Europeans were densely forested, rainforest, and you cannot conduct a triangulation survey in anywhere other than clear line of sight, where you've got clear visibility, and where you have high points to act as the vertices of your triangles. So what was known of equatorial Africa would have just been topographically impossible. So they chose equatorial South America, which was at the time controlled by the Spanish, who they correctly thought would cooperate. And also at the time, because the Spanish had subjected in the most cruel way indigenous South Americans to a colonial regime, it was a settled part of the world. It was somewhere that was well known. It was relatively well traveled by Europeans. The Spanish had been there for 200 years, so there were several generations of Spanish settlers there already, and an administrative structure that could be used by the scientists to help them. So it was the easiest option by far. And then the choice of going up in the Andes was simply to get above the rainforest. They had to travel through the rainforest to get up to the Andes, but they knew that there was this extraordinary feature now known as the Avenue of the Volcanoes, running south from Quito, where you have a corridor lined on each side by these incredibly spectacular volcanoes. And what they planned to do was to carry their quadrants up these volcanoes and use the volcanoes as gigantic survey stations where they assumed they'd be able to see all the other volcanoes and use those to do their triangulation.
Yeah, and of course they couldn't have known about it then, but we know now that because of plate tectonics theory that the subduction zone off the coast of South America there, the western coast, is why those volcanoes are aligned so perfectly, much like they are in the Cascade Range of the Pacific Northwest. If you look, you know, on Google Earth, they're just, you know, they're dots all in a line.
I should have talked about subduction zones in my book.
Going up through Oregon and Washington, you know, there it is. So, but they couldn't have known that. But it's interesting that they're in, you know, a place that Darwin was fascinated by, and he, you know, he also found the geology of that place spectacular, and it is.
Yes, they did some very good work. In fact, but this was before the age of popular European mountaineering, and yet they were forced to become mountaineers. And if you read Edward Whymper's amazing account of travels in the Andes several decades after this mission, he says in it that that he couldn't have undertaken his mountaineering expedition in the Andes if Le Condamine and his pals hadn't already been there making maps and climbing the mountains on these recce trips, on these reconnaissances.
Yeah. Well, one of the big problems they have when we consider, you know, you've got your baseline of your triangle, and now you just have to measure the angle. And now you've got something to sight on, you know, up on the slopes of one of these volcanoes or wherever. And all you got to do is take that angle. So you've got this all set up, and it should be a straightforward matter of sighting on that object. But then often the object, once they go to sight on it, is no longer there.
Yeah, it must have. Well, it did drive them completely mad. They had there were two main issues. Either they would set the quadrant up, and sometimes they were camping on these mountaintops for days or even weeks. On one of them, they're up there for 3 weeks, and then had to be carried down with altitude sickness. But they would. So their sightings were often ruined because of cloud cover, snowstorms, and all the rest of it. But they're also ruined because local people coming across the signals, as they called them, which were made of timber covered in white painted cloth held down by a rope so the wind wouldn't blow them away. So these, if you like, these timber and cloth pyramids were built on mountaintops to be used as sighting points, as signals for the quadrants. But the problem was that if a local came across this great timber and rope construction, of course, they took it away because it was very useful raw materials for making a cabin and a shepherd's hut and so on. So the signals kept disappearing. And each time a signal disappeared, they had to get on horseback, ride across a valley, climb a mountain, build another signal, paint it white, go all the way back again. And it took them days each time one disappeared. And then eventually they realized that the answer was not to use these laboriously constructed artificial pyramids of timber and cloth, but to use the white, small white army tents they had anyway, and to pitch those as signals, and then to sleep inside them. There's somebody who'd have to sleep in them while the sightings were taken from a distant mountain.
Yeah, otherwise those might disappear too.
Absolutely. They're more attractive.
And a lot of the local population, they didn't really know what these French scientists were up to. They thought they were probably, you know, searching for treasure.
That's right. I mean, the conquest of the Incas back in the early 1500s was very, very brutal. And the Inca civilization collapsed under this military onslaught from Spain. But a lot of the valuables, the incredible wealth of gold and silver, ornaments, jewelry, and so on, just disappeared. And there was always a belief that there was Inca treasure to be found. So whenever Europeans showed up in what became Ecuador, but was then the Viceroyalty of Peru, with strange instruments, they were assumed to be treasure hunters looking for lost Inca treasure. And of course, unfortunately, some of the members of the expedition, and Le Condamine in particular, was fascinated by the Incas. So he spent a lot of time asking questions about the Incas, which of course just underlined the suspicion that they really were treasure hunters, not, you know, that this, I mean, why would you want to measure the shape of the earth? It's utterly bizarre.
You know, and you mentioned the Incas, and Le Condamine in particular. A lot of the time that he gets distracted, it's to go check that civilization's remnants out. So that's another really cool aspect of this story, is that, you know, a lot of that is still there. Those the artifacts the foundations of the buildings and things that they built were, you know, especially fresh back in the early 1700s compared to, you know, what we would see today.
You're absolutely right. And I remember going to Inca Pirco back in the 1980s with my wife-to-be, and it's an incredible site. The you know, Inca masonry is famous for being very close-fitting and also adhering to various geometric principles. It's very beautiful to look at, quite austere. The actual stonework itself, the craftsmanship is quite extraordinary. I mean, you can't push a credit card between the joints of the masonry. And back then in the 1700s, of course, the landscape was still littered, dotted with ruins of these Inca buildings, not just the temples and the fortress and so on, but tambos, the kind of way stations, the inns along the Inca highway. So La Condamine was collecting notes, and then he was also secretly harvesting jewelry and various Inca pots and ceramics that he was putting in chests to send back to Europe. But there was one particular mountain where they were beset by very bad weather, and the weather was too bad to do surveying. And so he suggested to Bouger that they got on their horses and rode across the other side of the valley where he could see these remains, these Inca walls. And when he got there, he conducted, just in the space of one day, an accurate archaeological survey of this site. And it's the site of Inca Pirco that's now the single biggest, probably, tourist attraction in Ecuador. So he made what was at the time the first European accurate survey of an Inca archaeological site. And one of the things he saw there, it was kind of sad, but also very telling. He just notes casually in his journal that while he's doing his measurements, he had a compass, so he's looking at he was doing directional measurements as well as linear measurements with a ruler. But he notices that the farmer working adjacent land is busy casting away the stones from Inca Pirco to use in his house. So he actually saw the place being pulled apart with his own eyes.
Wow. That must have struck him as being odd. Oh, my. You know, what a loss.
Well, we have the same thing in the UK. I was recently walking a bit of Hadrian's Wall between England and Scotland. And, you know, a lot of Hadrian's Wall's only knee high now because if you go and look at the local farmhouses, you know, you'll probably find a lot of Hadrian's Wall in the villages and the towns nearby.
Repurposed,
yeah.
We're going to take a very short break, but when we come back, you'll hear more of my interview with Nicholas Crane as we talk about his new book, Latitude. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our visit with Nicholas Crane. He's the author of the new book, Latitude, The True Story of the World's First Scientific Expedition. It tells the story of a group of French scientists and Spanish military advisors who seek to measure the true shape of the Earth in what is now Ecuador back in the 18th century. Of course, it is the early 18th century, and medicine being what it was then, this expedition, illness is always, you know, kind of a harbinger of doom sitting right there on the edge. Could you talk a bit about, you know, some of the medical practices and the physicians that they had with them?
Yes, they had both a doctor and a surgeon with them, and they were beset continually by all sorts of problems. They were bitten by scorpions. There were snakes everywhere. One of the biggest worries was catching malaria. Indeed, the youngest of the 12 died within weeks of starting the survey from what was almost certainly malaria. They were using quinine. La Condamine had brought some quinine from Europe. At the time, it was known that the powdered bark of the cinchona tree was a very satisfactory cure for malaria. So it was already being exported from South America to Europe, and And Le Condamine had bought some in Europe to bring out with him, and then subsequently became obsessed by the cinchona tree and made his own journey to the cinchona groves. And so did Jusso, one of the expedition doctor and botanist. He also specialized in research on quinine. So that was the cinchona tree and quinine was absolutely fundamental to their success. And they also treated local people when they came across people with malaria, which helped with the PR somewhat. There were other ailments. There was a particularly nasty one known as VICO, or gangrene of the anus, and that was treated by inserting a lemon infused with pepper and gunpowder, and then changing it several times a day, which must have stung.
That sounds delightful.
Yeah, especially riding a horse. You know, I mean, the mind boggles. But it seems to have worked. They talk about it in their journals with satisfaction. It seemed to have done the job. I don't think it's being used today.
I hope not. But you know, in a pinch, as it were. And Le Condamine being interested in the bark of that tree, you know, that's so not surprising. He's like the scientific equivalent of a dog on a walk, you know. Oh, squirrel. Go over there and do this. Yeah. You know, he's easily distracted by all kinds of interesting things. He's very inquisitive.
He's inquisitive and reckless, and he also. Do you know what I think in Le Condamine's personality, which comes out among the surviving journals? His is the only personality to emerge, because Bugeaud is really quite austere. He only just talks about the mathematics, and Godin didn't. His records didn't survive. So really we just have Le Condamine as a firing from the hip account of what went on. Ulloa's account is wonderful for other reasons, which I could explain if you like, but Le Condamine's curiosity, as you say, it just bubbles over all of the time. He's irrepressible. And that's one of the reasons I love him. I mean, there's one moment late on in the expedition where he's down in the southern Andes, or the southern part of the Andes, where the navigation's incredibly difficult. This huge valley between the volcanoes had been pinched shut by the two Cordillera effectively meeting. So it made it much more difficult for them to conduct the survey. And he noticed that the other team were having a break, so he went off on a side trip to look for a lost Inca gold mine down in the rainforest. And he's rather coy about what he got up to in his journal, but he didn't find it, or at least he says he didn't find the gold. But he did find the most amazing crater lake, a turquoise crater lake, and did some research there, and among other things, learned that it had once belched fire and incinerated flocks of sheep on its slopes.
Wow. Yeah. And there's a really cool picture of that in the book.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Well, let's talk about how this all turns out, because it's arduous, very difficult work. And it takes years literally for them to really hit their stride and start, you know, getting the measurements compiled to the point where, you know, they're going to be able to do this. So could you talk a bit about, you know, how they finally got to where they needed to get and were able to get the measurements to determine what a degree of latitude is at the equator?
Yes. So the very first thing they did was to measure a very accurate baseline, the side of one of the first triangles, and they it took them weeks to find a suitable place, because what they needed was a long straight plateau or plane that along which they could lay out actually physically on the ground a straight line and then measure it. And interestingly, the place it wasn't the first place they selected, but they eventually settled on the plain of Yaraqui, which is now the main runway of Quito International Airport. So they were quite clever in finding the only long straight plateau anywhere near Quito. And that's what they used. It was 7 miles long. And they made an incredibly accurate baseline measurement of that. And from that, they extended their triangles basically southwards for a couple of hundred miles. measuring the angles until they got south of a town called Cuenca, which formed the bottom end of the chain of triangles, the southern end of the chain of triangles. And once they'd done that, they set up, this is an abbreviation of what actually happened, because they set up several observatories actually, but they set up an observatory at each end of the chain of triangles, and that's where they set up the zenith sectors to measure astronomically fix the two ends of the chain of triangles. They then had to settle down to an epic of mathematics. Now, this was all conducted by this time Gaudin had disappeared, and it's really just Bouguer and Lacondamine who are driving this thing on, with Bouguer really the only truly competent mathematician. Lacondamine makes a great show in his journals of being able to keep up with the maths, but he also says he absolutely hated the maths. I think he was struggling probably. Very good at the practical side of things, but not so good at the equations.
Yeah, well, I could see that being a royal pain. Once you got all these measurements compiled, it's like, well, now you have to take the data and, you know, figure out what it means. And that involves a lot of number crunching. A
huge amount of number crunching. But they saw it through to the end and actually came up with the resulting number while they were still there. And then they beat it back to Europe. I think just to recap on something we were talking about earlier, I think one of the reasons that Lacondamine allowed himself to be so continually distracted and the reason why they persevered for so many years is that back in the 1730s, you were never going to get a second chance to go to equatorial South America. It took them a year just to travel out there on ships and then overland by horse. So they knew that it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So I think for Lacondamine, it was a chance to harvest as much wonder, as much science as he possibly could while he was there, knowing that he would never get the chance to go back. And of course, they realized that the more they went back with, and we're not just talking about the latitude figure, but all the other research they did as well on gravity, the speed of sound, and so on, the more likely they were to be made for life, to be acclaimed within the Academy of Sciences as absolutely brilliant scientists who had changed the Enlightenment. So that was really their ambition, to be seen as furthering science.
Yeah, and when you mention the gravitational experiments, they're using pendulums, right, to try to determine the local acceleration of gravity where they are?
Yes, Lacondamine had his own pendulum built, actually, a kind of mountaineering pendulum in a wooden box. And the idea was that a mass of a volcano or a mountain had its own gravitational attraction to the pendulum, so it would distort the swing of the pendulum. And they counted the pendulum swings while the pendulum was set up close to a large volcano to prove or disprove this. And then they moved the pendulum to other locations to see whether it varied further away from that mountain mass. So yes, they were conducting all sorts of experiments along the way. Bouguer was fascinated by the aberration of light and spent some time down on the coast doing research on that. There's also descriptions of various other metals and the two that they came across on the travels, and the two Spanish naval lieutenants came up with what to my mind is one of the most important insights that the mission managed to gather in all of their 10 years on the equator, which was on human rights abuses in South America, in colonial South America. So the two Spaniards had been told by the Spanish king that they were to undertake a discreet survey of colonial administration, its abuses, its corruption, and so on, while they were on the mission. And I don't think the French part of the expedition were really aware of just how much time the two Spaniards were devoting to this, but they came back with a mass of information about human rights abuses, often related to the MITRE system, which allowed the Spanish landlords, overseers, factory managers to turn their fiefdoms into slave territories. So the local people had to work in these factories. They had to buy their food, their clothing, their accommodation from the factory owners. And the charges, the prices for food and for clothing and so on were such that they would have to borrow money from the factory owner to pay for them. So they would die in debt, and then that debt would be inherited by their own children. It was a truly appalling system. And the two Spanish naval lieutenants kept very detailed notes. And when they got back to Spain, they presented the secret dossier to the king. And it's very unclear what effect it had on Spanish policy in South America, but it was subsequently published by an American author, Tapask, and it's one of the most heartrending but also brilliant documents related to the mission that there is.
Yeah, well, it just goes to show you there's so many aspects of this mission. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, like you said, they're spending a long period of time. This is the only time they're going to be able to do this. And there's so many different personalities on this expedition that it's a kaleidoscope of stories. And I imagine that must have been, for you as an author, that must have been one of the challenges, is to try to, you know, take all of these disparate characters and threads and weave it into a narrative, because that's not an easy thing to do.
No, it was a real challenge. And, you know, I wanted to write a story. There have been other books about the mission, most brilliantly Larry Ferrero's book, The Measure of the Earth, American nonfiction writer, who wrote a very good book indeed about the mission, but a very thorough book. I wanted to write, a more linear narrative, and I kind of deliberately gave the game away in the opening paragraph of the book, which is, a respectful homage to Joseph Conrad and the opening lines of Heart of Darkness. So I've used the departure of the French frigate from Rochefort on the French coast. I've described that departure in the same way that Conrad describes the departure of the ship at the beginning of Heart of Darkness from Pool of London towards the Belgian Congo. So I'm sure many readers spotted that the Conrad connection. I just wanted to kind of quietly signpost the fact that this is not a work of objective, necessarily academic thoroughness. I wanted to tell a story, and that meant slimming things down. If you've got 12 members on the expedition that are known to have been on the expedition, and of course, and I do talk about this in the book, there were multiples more than that who made it possible in the local people who helped, in the various slaves that were helping them, none of whom are named. Actually, one was named, but nearly all of them were not named. The porters, the people who provided food, the people who carried the tents, who built the signals. So hundreds of other people made this mission successful, but none of them were named. So I didn't novelize the story, but what I did do was realize that with 12 protagonists, you can't create a clean story with 12 different main characters. So some of them have to kind of rise to the top and be your focal points. And that's why how could I resist Le Condamine? He becomes the main, kind of not the only character, but he's the foil to Bouguer. The two of them are the Laurel Hardy of the mission, really.
Yeah, I can almost imagine Johnny Depp playing him.
Yes. Oh, that would be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, of course, they are in the long run successful in proving that the Earth is an oblate spheroid. When we look at it from our lens of the 21st century, how accurate were they?
Yeah, very accurate. And I think it's and obviously subsequently with satellite mapping and GPS and so on, the figure's been revised, but they were very close. And I think it was the closest the Enlightenment House to a moonshot. It was an Apollo mission at the time, you know, 10 years in the making. It was the world's first international scientific expedition. And yet I think because the Anglophone world here in the UK, there's a story better known in America than in the UK. And I think because it was a Spanish and French mission, it's a story that's not that well known in England, and I think it's much better known in the States.
Well, Nicholas Crane, thanks for joining us to talk about Latitude and, like I said, the Apollo moonshot of the early 18th century, because it really was quite an epic story.
Thank you so much. That was such a lovely conversation to be having on a cold, dark, a very wintry night in England.
Thanks again to our guest, Nicholas Crane. His new book, Latitude, The True Story of the World's First Scientific Expedition, is published by Pegasus Books and available at most major booksellers. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that at our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fiddler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.